Welcome back to The Lead, a podcast about content marketing by Copyblogger Media. I'm your host, Jared Morris. This episode of The Lead is brought to you by Authority Rainmaker, Copyblogger's second annual live conference focused on providing content marketing training and networking opportunities for real-world results. Authority Rainmaker takes place in May 2015 and will be held at the stunning Ellie Calkins Opera House in Denver, Colorado. Keynote presentations will be delivered by Daniel Pink, Sally Hogshead, and Henry Rollins. Super early bird pricing is still available. Go to authorityrainmaker.com for details. For so many of us, the end of every year revolves around holiday celebrations and spending quality time with friends and family, as it should. But the end of the year is also a time for purposeful reflection, for considering the successes and failures of the year gone by, and for making sure that lessons have been learned and that plans are in place to hit the ground running in the new year. On this episode of The Lead, Damian Farnworth and I spend a little time purposefully reflecting on 2014 and the most important lessons we will carry forward with us into 2015. Damian, when you reflect back on 2014, what sticks out in your mind?
What sticks out in my mind? The fact that you roared on one of our episodes.
Okay, that's ridiculous. What about what about content?
Content marketing. Okay, content marketing. Okay, so thinking back over 2014, I think of two major events that kind of, defined content marketing, but at least changed the course, gave it a rumble, so to speak, and that would be when Google killed authorship, and the other one being the emergence of native advertising. So,
and what was it about? Let's start with Google killing authorship, because obviously that was big news. What was it about that that really sticks out? And more importantly, what can we take from that? You know, kind of in a general sense.
Yeah, that's great. So Google authorship was something that Google rolled out about 3 years ago in June, and it was supposed to be a major sort of it was an experiment. And so, as we know with Google, you know, nothing's a sacred cow, and it comes down to the experiment failed. That's what ultimately the decision was, the experiment failed. Google authorship, though, what that was meant to do was it was allow authors to claim their content and then display it in search results with markup code. So over the past 3 years, we've probably all seen when we've gone to Google and searched for something, we saw some of those entries had photos on them. And that's the display or the image support that Google allowed. So what Google was trying to do was trying to connect authors with their content. So because they had PageRank, and PageRank was meant to sort of evaluate and judge content based upon what was in that page. The other half of that equation has to be, well, who's the author, right? They wanted to bring in the authority portion of that. And so it was not just what was the content of the page, but who wrote it that was important. And authorship was their attempt to do that. And but that just, it didn't work out. They killed image support. Like, they actually, in the December of 2013, reduced image support, and then ultimately killed it in June 2014. And then just this past August, end of the August, in a blog post, Google said it's done and it's gone. The reasons why they did it was, first, there was just low adoption rates. Like, people weren't implementing it. It was somewhat complex. It was even absent in some verticals. You go to some, you know, industries, and it was completely absent. Nobody was implementing it. And in fact, it was such a low adoption rate. Like, only 30% of the top 50 most influential social media marketers had implemented authorship. So of those who you think it would be most important to, weren't even getting involved with it, weren't even interested. Another, the other portion of it too, the reason that it failed was that it just had low value to searchers. Like, the novelty had worn off. Google sees, like, half their search comes from mobile, and it was messing up the user, the photo, the authorship snippets, all that was just messing up the search portion of it. So they killed it.
So, however, and let me jump in here, because if we're looking at kind of lessons, you know, what we can take from this, obviously when authorship came out, there was a pretty big rush of people, especially in our industry, who implemented it on their sites, and with good reason. And it also seemed to really increase Google Plus usage there for a while. Mm-hmm. Now, once they removed authorship, you know, it feels like people have started to use Google Plus less. And the lesson, as always, is, you know, with Google, with any of these social media sites, you have to be careful always about putting too many eggs in that basket, because the rules of the game can change at any time, just as they did here. So it's not that, you know, going after authorship and implementing on their site, it wasn't a waste of time by any means, but it's just another lesson that these things can change. So, you know, it's just kind of one portion of your strategy, but you never want to go all in on anything that you don't control.
That's right. And I wouldn't be surprised, even though they've said contrary, I wouldn't be surprised at some point in the future that Google kills Google Plus, because it's a social site now and as it stands. And that's the only function that it's really serving, unless they find something, you know, fundamental to use it towards. If it's not serving some sort of business objective, I would not doubt that that goes away too. So, but yeah, because we saw comments and such, you know, drop off on our actual our copy blogger profile, and I think part of that is the reason behind authorship. However, this is to say, though, AuthorRank itself, the concept that Google is trying to judge content based on who wrote it, that in itself is not dead. And Danny Sullivan at Search Engine Land, he says this himself in a good little article we'll provide in the show notes, because it's still being used in what's known as the in-depth articles. And of course, Google, they haven't told us this, but they have other ways of identifying author authority. And ultimately, as you kind of alluded to, it's, you know, we've always said, and Brian said in a article that he wrote, that he asked the question, what if AuthorRank never happens? The answer is, it doesn't matter. As long as you're still building authority, creating great content, that sort of thing, then you have nothing to fear. You know, what we've been teaching you for the last 7-8 years, continue to do those things and you're in good shape.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that highlights for me one of the kind of overarching lessons that has become, I mean, it's kind of an obvious one, but it's become a lot more clear to me this year. And that is the necessity. You know, obviously we're all in business, right? You know, an online business, and we're in business to make money, but to make money while serving an audience. And that's why I think it's so important to understand this intersection of where you offer the most value to your audience and then what drives profit in your business. And this is going to be different for everyone, right? So, you know, two decisions we made this year that you know, created a lot of discussion, were removing blog comments and killing our Facebook page. And some people agreed with that, some people didn't, and everyone's entitled to their own opinion. For us, it really came down to, you know, understanding where we provide the most value for our audience, you know, with limited resources. We can't be everywhere at all times and everything to all people. So where do we provide the most value? And then in terms of our business, what is the smartest in terms of what actually drives revenue and profit for the business? And that, you know, understanding that intersection is what led to those decisions. And it's what you have to understand and think about when you are entertaining, you know, should we go after Google Plus? Should we step back from Google Plus? What social networks are we going to invest in? You know, what kind of content are we going to invest in? And so, you know, that it really is a lesson that it's not specific to 2014, but this idea of understanding that intersection of where you're providing value for your audience and where you derive the most business value from, really in guiding your decision making.
That's right.
So let's move on to the next one. I know that you want to talk about native advertising, and you obviously did a big, you know, research project on native advertising. So as you kind of reflect back on that, what are your thoughts now about native advertising?
So native advertising has got to be like the buzzword of the year, I think, because it's pretty much, especially the start of the year, huge, and people talking about it, companies coming out of the woodworks in order to support it. And basically, the funny thing is, though, we did the series, we did the survey, not very many people actually knew what it is. I mean, in fact, in our survey results demonstrated nearly 50% of the respondents didn't have a clue what native advertising is, and another 48% had a shaky understanding of what it was. There's only like a 3% who like were very knowledgeable about it. And I guarantee that was probably all these businesses that sort of cropped up to sort of serve this need. But basically, native advertising is it's just, for those who don't know, it's paid content that matches a publication's editorial standards while meeting the audience's expectations. For example, you go to BuzzFeed And you can see lots of examples of promoted content of native advertising, right? You can see, if you go there right now, you'll see promoted content by PlayStation. You'll see it by Heinz. Another thing too is that native advertising is not new. It's just how it's just new to online. It's new to the because David Ogilvy was doing native advertising back when he did campaigns for Guinness beer, and we termed that though an advertorial. Was basically it looked like an article, right? It looked like a top 10 best of list. But it was for Guinness. It was to promote their beer. It was had a clear call to action, which is basically, you know, it was that Guinness guide to eating oysters. You eat oysters, and it's best to wash that down with Guinness beer. Same thing online, you know. So that's the editorial side of native advertising. There's also the what's it called, like the in-feed ad side of it. So like Twitter's promoted posts, Facebook's promoted stories. You know, you'll see like in-stream ads inside apps, and then Google Text ads are also an idea of native advertising. It's advertising that is basically invading, coming into the editorial space, but it's designed to look like as if it was editorial, if it was an article.
Okay, so let me ask, I mean, is it working? You know, that's kind of what it is. Does it work, and what opportunities does it provide, especially, you know, as we kind of look forward into next year?
Yeah, so that's a great question, right? Because here's the thing: this is native advertising has been a boon for publishers because you know we've seen all these sort of big just blue chip media companies come collapsing down because they can't compete in the online world. Well, here comes native advertising because what they're doing is these publishers are selling major real estate at a premium price, and advertisers are actually paying for this space. So it's saving, you know, this revenue model is actually saving these businesses. BuzzFeed's a great example. Vice is another example. For the time being, this revenue model is profitable. The question is, like you said, will it be profitable in the long run? This is to be seen. Because eventually the novelty will wear off, and in fact, though this sponsored content, this native advertising, does have a trust problem, right? Contently ran a survey in 2014, basically demonstrated that people look at, say, an advertorial on Entrepreneur magazine by Dell, they'll look at it like with a very skeptical eye, and then Chartbeat. In early 2014, they did a survey to another data analytics companies, and they said people are simply not scrolling on this content. So either advertisers are going to wisen up and say, you know, native advertising isn't working otherwise, or they create content that's really, really going to be compelling and will actually engage an audience and maybe close that gap between, you know, that trust gap that's there. So the opportunities are twofold, I think. Brands are hiring a lot more writers to sort of fill this gap. They see the value in native advertising, in sponsored content, in promoted content, so they want to fill that, so they have to hire more writers. And we've kind of seen that. We've seen a lot of journalists become content marketers. But also, this could be a revenue model for small-time publishers, you know, actually allowing brands to come in and create content for their site as an ad. But again, this is like you mentioned earlier, this is not something you'd hang, you know, all of your eggs in one basket at all.
Yeah, and for some, you know, advertisers, native advertising isn't going to be possible simply because of the budget. You know, like you said, it's a big mm-hmm. opportunity for small-time publishers, but when you look at it from the content creator side, it's not always going to be feasible. And that leads me into another, you know, kind of lesson from 2014 and a trend, which is, you know, there's a lot of discussion about this idea of content shock, and you know, there's all this content mm-hmm. out there. So how do you rise above that? And it really comes down to you've got to create better content, right? I mean, that simply doesn't change. That the quality of your content, its usefulness to an audience, has to continue to get better, and that may mean thinking outside the box and finding new ways to reach people, new ways to maximize different mediums. And part of what, you know, most of the audience who's listening to this, you know, we at Copyblogger, we don't have unlimited resources or unlimited budgets, right? And so right. That means if we're going to, you know, invest more in our content, Well, we've got to take time and effort and resources away from something else. And so that means that, you know, kind of this balance between the content and then the, you know, kind of the technology side, if you can find ways to be more efficient with what you're doing on the technology side, it will give you more resources on the content side, you know, and obviously for us, you know, we released the Rainmaker platform as kind of the solution to that, you know, where, you know, so much of the technical part of your business is taken care of in this one platform so that you can focus more on the content. And I think as we look into 2015, that is going to continue to be so important, especially for publishers, advertisers, companies who don't have unlimited resources, which is most of us, to find ways to be more efficient on technology so that you can invest more into your content, make your content better so that you can be more successful with your content marketing efforts.
Right. Yeah. And I think to add to that, this idea of content shock, you know, it's a silly idea because really we've always been under a deluge of content. There's never been a shortage. I can't think of any time in my past that I've ever had a surplus of time to consume all the content that was out there. It's always been a flood of content. Really what it's about is content fatigue, right? Saying the same thing over and over. And I think being efficient, the better word is probably being effective with your content. And instead of like, you know, that might mean instead of a daily publishing schedule, maybe it's twice a week. So you focus on something because the thing is you have to figure out a way to rise above the noise. And if you can pour more of your resources in on one piece of content, then you're going to do better than if you're spreading it out over five. And also it's this idea of creating asset pillars, you know, and I talked about this in a blog post on infographics as being an asset pillar that would sort of reduce your content strategy time by allowing you to create, you know, out of the asset pillar being the infographic, bringing in other resources, other articles. Say you wrote like five different articles in the archives. You take those, you create an infographic, and then you create a podcast, you know, from that infographic like we did with the 11, you know, essential ingredients, the blog post. So it's being smarter with what you have especially for the small time, you know, publishers that allows you to pour more energy and focus and creativity into one particular piece of content. So it gives you a fighting chance versus spreading yourself thin.
Yep. No, it's a great point. So one more topic here before we close out this episode, and that is empathy, which is one of the biggest buzzwords from 2014. Anybody who attended our conference, our first authority conference in Denver in May, you know, empathy was a big word. And really carried throughout the entire year. So let's close up by talking about this idea of empathy and then also how it influences kind of that next step idea of experience and journey maps.
Okay, so empathy, right, is this idea of relating to your customer, of being in their shoes, but then wanting to provide sort of some sort of, like solution to their problem. For example, I have empathy for freelancers because I've been in their shoes and I understand that. I know where they're at. And so I can speak to them. Their plight resonates with my plight. And so being able to do that is what we're after. And so really, empathy is just another way of something that we've been saying for quite some time, which is about a focus on the customer, right, rather than upon ourselves. And we're constantly fighting this. I think from a commercial standpoint, we're historically fighting this idea of getting away from me, you know, it's all about me, the brand, to it's all really about the customer. And so we're trying to experience. So in the empathy sense, what we're trying to do is just relate to them. Like Google did this when they were promoting some of their Google products, like a Gmail. They did it through their, you know, the dad chronicling the birth of his daughter and she's growing up, and he did it with Google products. That's empathy, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was it Tide who did a commercial for, you know, moms mothers who are raising Olympic athletes, mm-hmm. and all that they do for them, you know, is a short commercial, but it's basically, we understand, we see what you do. So we want to create a product that helps you do your job better because of that. So that's empathy there.
And as we look forward to, you know, to 2015, actually our next episode here of The Lead, kind of tying what we learned in 2014 into what we're, you know, going to focus on in 2015, empathy is really the first step toward being able to provide the most personalized experience to your users? Because obviously you have to understand what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're going through to really be able to tailor content that's going to fit their needs at any given time. And, right. you know, I think one of the concepts that is starting to gain some traction that will gain even more traction in 2015 is adaptive content. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can't adapt content if you don't understand who you're adapting it for. And so that's why empathy is such an important building block, such an important foundational principle. And we're going to talk about that in our next episode. You know, this episode is more about looking back to 2014. And our next episode, which will be the final episode of The Lead in 2014, we will look ahead to 2015 and talk about some of the trends that we expect to see and how we individually and as a company are planning to capitalize on those.
Right.
Any final thoughts here, Mr. Farnworth, before we close?
Yeah, so I was just going to say I have an article coming out on experience maps, which will explain more of what we're talking about here. But, you know, it's just a natural kind of progression from empathy to experience map. And experience map is just it's a story of how your customer interacts with your product and your brand from start to finish. Now, we talked about this with Brian, but as I did more research on it, it became clear that it's just a natural sort of next step to what we're calling adaptive content. Because once you understand who your customer is and the interactions they have through them, and you see the high points and you see the low points, then you can create a better, like a sublime, sublime customer experience from that experience map. And something that I suggest is creating then a prescriptive map, meaning looking forward, what is the most sublime supreme customer experience that you can create? And you can only do that by resonating, knowing your audience, knowing your customer, creating that experience map, and then creating that content, which then adapts to how they interact with your brand.
Well, in closing, Damien, I know we're recording this podcast before Thanksgiving, but it'll be released after. But I just want you to know that I'm very thankful for you and for your contributions to The Lead.
Oh, that's very, very, very sweet of you. I need to find a tissue.
All right,
I am very, very grateful for you too, Jared, honestly.
Thank you.
Yes, and you have a wonderful in your new home with your gal. You guys have a wonderful. So, are you guys spending Thanksgiving in your new home?
No. We actually we're kind of doing the family thing this year, and then okay. Next year will be the first time that we kind of bring everybody together in the house.
Great. So, right. Well, yes. Good. All right,
yes,
buddy.
Yes. All right, man. Well, hey, always a pleasure, and we'll be back to wrap up the year in a couple weeks.
Sounds good, man. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Lead. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving the show a rating or a review on iTunes. We would greatly appreciate it. And don't forget to go to authorityrainmaker.com and check out all the details about the Authority Rainmaker live conference coming in May of 2015. You won't want to miss it, and the super early bird pricing is still available. All right, everybody, we will be back next week, 2 weeks from now, actually, with one final episode to wrap up 2014 as we look forward to 2015.
So I wish I was a slave to an age-old trade. Lord, have mercy on me.